The intent of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Education Today. For the next half hour, I will be finishing an article that we started last time, and this article is titled Vision for Inclusion, Key Steps to Make College Accessible for Visually Impaired Students. When we ended last time, we were under the section of Campus Layout and Physical Accessibility, so I'm going to finish that section, and then we should be able to finish the rest of the article. Appropriate signage for low vision or no vision students includes bright, simple pictures depicting specific navigation situations, large lettering, and/or accompanying braille labeling at elevators, outside classrooms, and in dorms. This ensures that the visually impaired student knows what room they're entering, can call the elevator, and can exit the building safely. Consistent communication with the campus disability office is very important if these navigation tools are missing or inadequate. Visually impaired students must alert campus staff about concerns or problems that impede their ability to learn. Classroom accessibility. Accessible classrooms and learning spaces are important for visually impaired students to succeed. From physical navigation to open communication with instructors, certain adaptations within the classroom, as well as the use of technology aids, plays an important role in ensuring an equal opportunity to learn. Before classes begin. Most college students benefit from taking some foundational steps before classes begin to minimize stress and maximize the benefits of a great learning environment. This is especially true for visually impaired students. Some actions to consider. 1. Early communication. Introduce yourself to your professors at the start of the semester, explain your visual impairment, and discuss any necessary accommodations. 2. Campus previews. Explore the campus ahead of time. If possible, familiarize yourself with classroom locations and building layouts to reduce stress on the first day. 3. Technology prep. Ensure your assistive technology, screen readers, magnifiers, etc., is charged, updated, and working correctly before you head to class. Getting to class on time. Allow extra travel time between classes, especially if you are on a particularly large campus, and be sure to utilize transportation options offered by your college. You may also consider 1. Wayfinding apps. Use apps like Blind Square or NaviLens for detailed navigation instructions and information about your surroundings. 2. Familiarize yourself. Consider asking a friend or using disability services assistance to get to unfamiliar classrooms and find seating during the first few weeks. Inside the classroom. Once you've made it to class and are familiar with the schedule and layout of the classroom itself, there are some adjustments visually impaired students can make to maximize their learning experience. These adjustments include 1. Preferential seating. Discuss preferred seating with your professor. For example, you may need to be close to the board to see better, near outlets to charge your devices, or you may need extra space for a cane or assistance dog. 2. Lighting considerations. For students with low vision, request a seat away from glare or with good lighting. Number 3, note-taking strategies. You can use a slate and stylus to type notes onto paper in Braille. Some students prefer digital Braille note-takers that also store notes and other important information. Some students choose to record lectures with recording devices. Most campuses offer note-taking assistance through the Disability Services Office. 4. Exam accommodations. Discuss any needs you might have for taking exams with professors or campus services. Find out ahead of time if you can complete an oral exam or receive extra time to accommodate your needs. 5. Advocate for yourself. If the instructor's teaching style is visual, request additional explanations, oral descriptions of visual displays, or alternative ways to access the information. Adaptive materials and technology are paramount to a visually impaired student's success in the classroom. The following tools can help. 1. Braille books. 2. Screen readers. 3. Recording devices. 4. Laptops and specialized apps. 5. Large print materials. 6. Magnifying devices for reading and note-taking. And 7. Braille note-taking devices and displays. Extra tips for support. Connect with other visually impaired students for advice and resources. This is also a great way to build community and avoid isolation. If you have to expend a large amount of time and effort to navigate college life with a visual impairment, it can be easy to neglect friendships and social time. Also, be sure to keep in touch with your professors and disability services throughout the semester for ongoing support. Take advantage of your instructor's office hours to discuss extra concerns. Campus transportation. Disability transportation services are different on each campus. To find out exactly what is available for you, talk to your disability services office to explain your needs and find the best options available. Some options may include 1. Campus shuttles and buses. Many colleges offer accessible shuttle or bus services with features like automated stop announcements, tactile signage at stops, and designated low floor sections for easy boarding with canes or guide dogs. These shuttles could be as large as a van or as small as a golf cart. Be sure to check with your campus services office for more information if you need a larger vehicle. Number 2, paratransit services. Some institutions may partner with local paratransit services, offering door-to-door transportation for students whose visual impairment makes it difficult to get around campus. This is also useful if construction has altered familiar routes and walking is difficult. And number 3, navigating public transportation. As part of orientation and mobility training, many college students with visual impairment have a chance to learn local and campus bus routes, stops, and schedules. It's also great to check with on-campus disability services for more detailed information about the local public transportation system. Conclusion. Visually impaired students face significant challenges, but there are solutions available to ensure a rewarding college experience. With the appropriate navigation tools, note-taking strategies, transportation options, mobility training, and much more, students with vision impairment can confidently enter the world of higher education. When colleges embrace accessible technology, prioritize inclusive learning and teaching practices, and provide adequate support, they create campuses where everyone can learn and thrive. And that concludes this article, Vision for Inclusion, Key Steps to Make College Accessible for Visually Impaired Students. And this was written by Stephanie Spillman. And now I'm going to share some various news articles for you for our blind, print impaired, and sighted communities. The first article that I'm going to start with is from the North Carolina Association of Educators, and this is regarding the Supreme Court decision on Leandro case, and this was released on April 2nd by NCAE Communications. The North Carolina Association of Educators, or NCAE, is expressing its disgust with the North Carolina Supreme Court's decision to throw out the multi-billion dollar Leandro case. After waiting more than three decades for the promise of Leandro to be fulfilled, the state Supreme Court has decided to neglect its duties and the 1.5 million children that attend North Carolina's public schools. Today, thousands of North Carolina students walked into overcrowded classrooms and crumbling school buildings, said Tamika Walker Kelly, NCAE president. And thousands of educators are committed to the young people of this state in spite of the state's failure to adequately fund our schools because we believe that every child deserves the best we can give them. Today, the majority of the North Carolina Supreme Court made it clear they do not share that belief. What the court tries to pass off as a legal technicality is, instead, a moral failure. The people paying the price for our leaders' failure are not abstractions. They are the generations of children in rural communities, past and present, who waited for 30 years for a promise never fulfilled. They are the parents and caregivers who did it all for their kids while the state failed to live up to its end of the bargain. And they are the educators who have given everything to a profession that this state continues to undervalue. Don't forget, North Carolina is ranked dead last in public school funding. No state does less for its public schools than North Carolina. That fact was cemented today by our highest court. For all North Carolinians, the constitutional promise of a sound basic education was not erased today. It was betrayed by those in power who believe that corporate tax cuts are more important than our future generations. Until the people of North Carolina rise up, reclaim our democracy, and restore checks and balances, our kids will never be this state's top priority. While North Carolina families have demanded strong public schools for our kids, politicians and their billionaire backers have refused to listen. That's why educators and public school supporters are gathering in Raleigh on May 1st to highlight our state's misplaced priorities and refocus the attention of this state on the children it has failed. This is our line in the sand. From the last article, I did read about a gathering that would take place on May 1st, and I wanted to share more of that with you. The North Carolina Association of Educators, or NCAE, alongside thousands of educators, parents, and community allies from across the state will gather for the Kids Over Corporations rally on May 1st at Halifax Mall in Raleigh. The rally represents the culmination of growing frustration among educators, students, and communities over the state's continued failure to adequately invest in public schools, the 1.5 million students they serve, and the educators who support them. Next, I want to share a story with you from the National Federation of the Blind, and it's titled, "But I Don't Know How to Dance," by Catherine Horn Randall. Kathy is a longtime leader in the National Federation of the Blind of Illinois. Not too long ago, she lost her husband, Bob, a partner in all she did, including her federationism. Here is how she tells their beautiful story. When I was growing up in Quincy, Illinois, no one ever suggested that I was blind. People said I didn't see very well, and I wore glasses for reading, but the B word was never spoken. Like many other low-vision kids at that time, I attended what they used to call a sight-saving class. Children from kindergarten through eighth grade were all taught in the same classroom, with the teacher scampering from one kid to the next. We had some of our classes, such as music, with the mainstream kids. Apart from touch typing, which I started in sixth grade, I can't say I learned much in the sight-saving classroom. The playground was a different story. That's where I learned to fight. Once a boy started teasing me, calling me four eyes, and I beat the heck out of him. When he begged me to stop, I told him we could be friends as long as he promised never to tease me that way again. He promised. After that, we became good friends, and he never broke his word. I was fully mainstreamed in high school, and that's when I fell in love with literature. Shakespeare really opened the door to learning for me. I had plenty of friends, some I met at school and some who were the children of my parents' friends. It was a happy time for me, and when I graduated, I was ready to go away to college. I enrolled at McMurry College in Jacksonville, Illinois. It was a small coeducational liberal arts college founded in 1846. The academic work was challenging, and I spent a lot of time studying, but I found plenty of time to have an active social life. One of the fellows I dated occasionally was a tall, shy guy named Bob Randall, who went to Illinois College, a school nearby. During my junior year, I went to Bob and told him, "Bob, will you take me to the homecoming dance at McMurry?" He said, "Kathy, I'd love to, but I don't know how to dance." I said, "Fine, I'll teach you." So I went over to his apartment and gave him dancing lessons. As it turned out, we danced together for the next 55 years. Looking back, I sometimes marvel that Bob had the guts to admit that he didn't know how to dance. Even more, I appreciate his complete lack of concern about my blindness. It never was a problem for him at all, even when I lost my remaining vision in my 30s. His mother was a different story. She asked him, "Are you sure you want to get involved with Kathy? That girl can hardly see." Bob told her, "I'm sure." Eventually, his mother and I became good friends. When Bob and I got married, I still had one more semester of college to go. My name on my diploma is Catherine Horn Randall. Bob and I lived in an apartment off campus, and later we bought a house in Jacksonville, where we spent the next 55 years. I taught him about literature, and he taught me about birds. Together, we went on birding expeditions all over the world. I often think how blessed I have been that I met a guy with the courage to admit that he didn't know how to dance and the willingness to let me teach him. Did you know that the National Library Service for Blind and Print Disabled provides reading materials at no cost to individuals whose temporary or permanent low vision, blindness, physical disability, or other disability makes it difficult to read regular print? Services are administered through a network of cooperating libraries across the United States. NLS readers may receive materials in two ways: via download to a personal device through the Braille and Audio Reading Download, or BARD, app website, or through the United States Postal Service. In either case, there is no charge. The service is available to all U.S. residents and citizens living abroad. To find your local library or to speak with a librarian, call 1-888-657-7323. Again, that number is 1-888-657-7323. 3-2-3 and follow the prompts. You can also visit the NLS website. Next, I want to share with you some information about sun protection from the National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation. Of course, it's getting hotter and we may be spending more time outside, and I think these are some useful tips for sun protection. People with albinism can enjoy the outdoors by limiting their exposure to sunlight, wearing appropriate hats and clothing, and using sunscreens diligently. However, the task of preventing damage to the skin over a lifetime is a difficult one. Preventing sunburn is important, but not sufficient to prevent sun-damaged skin. It is an invisible part of the light spectrum of the sun, the ultraviolet light that damages skin. The shorter wavelength ultraviolet light, UVB, has a much bigger role in causing sunburn than the longer wavelength UVA. Manufacturers made sunscreens to block UVB and not UVA, so normally pigmented people could tan without burning. Newer research suggests that UVA, since it penetrates more deeply, may cause skin cancer and premature aging of the skin. Now, sunscreen manufacturers label sunscreens as broad spectrum, which means they block both UVB and UVA. Sunscreens. People with albinism should use sunscreens labeled SPF 30 or higher. SPF means sun protection factor. This number comes from a standard test in a laboratory. The test measures the time it takes people wearing a standard amount of sunscreen to sunburn under a standard ultraviolet lamp compared to the time with no sunscreen. In theory, if a person could stay in the sun 10 minutes without burning with no sunscreen, he or she could wear an SPF 20 sunscreen and stay in the sun 20 times 10 minutes or 200 minutes before burning. In actual use, a sunscreen may not provide as much sunburn protection as expected from its SPF rating, largely because people do not apply enough. Most people apply about half as much as the amount used for SPF test. Full body protection for an adult requires 9 portions of 1/2 teaspoon each, or total of about an ounce. For sunscreens that come in 4-ounce bottles, this amounts to 1/4 of the bottle per application. It helps to apply the sunscreen 1/2 hour before going into the sun, since some of the screening chemicals bind to the skin. Remember that rubbing with towels or friction from clothing, such as between the legs, can remove protection. Simple immersion in water does not remove protection of sunscreens marked very water resistant or water resistant. The FDA has proposed dropping the term waterproof. Most people, especially children, do more in the water than just immerse themselves. They may rub off some of the sunscreen, and the old warning to reapply after swimming may be wise. Don't forget to put sunscreen on the tops of ears, the backs of arms and legs, and bicyclists need to protect the low back, where shirts often ride up. Should people with albinism go for the highest SPF available? Using sunscreens with SPF higher than 30 offers little benefit, and more concentrated chemicals might be more likely to irritate or cause an allergic rash. The FDA has proposed limiting the number to 30. For people with albinism, it is important not to rely on sunscreens and to limit exposure to the sun. Most ultraviolet rays come between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. standard time or 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. daylight savings time. Planning outdoor activities for morning or evening is the single most important measure for people with albinism to avoid sun damage. The National Weather Forecasting Service gives predictions of UV risk on a scale of 1, which is low, to 10, which is high for many communities. They base these predictions on the angle of the sun at noon at that place and date, the altitude, and the predicted cloud cover. In addition to the UV forecast, consider your surroundings. Sand reflects 25% or more of ultraviolet rays, so that is possible to get sunburned while sitting in the shade on a beach. Fresh snow reflects 70 to 90% of ultraviolet rays. Water can also reflect UV rays. Reflected light may burn areas which are usually shaded, such as those under the nose or chin. As much as 96% of ultraviolet rays can penetrate clear water. Clothing is important. Up to 50% of the ultraviolet rays can go through wet cotton t-shirts worn for swimming. Colored clothing and denser woven clothing allow less light penetration. Several manufacturers are promoting densely woven, breathable synthetic fiber clothes for sun protection. These allow protection with long sleeves in warm weather. With time, this type of clothing may become less expensive and more common. Hats are essential. Hats with brims at least 3 inches wide all the way around are best for protecting the face, ears, and neck. Hats with narrow brims, such as tennis hats, at least protect the ears. Ultraviolet light over many years creates actinic changes in skin and increases the risk of skin cancers. These problems are a cause for concern, but not alarm. Actinic changes include fine wrinkling, yellowish discoloration, leathery thickening, and dilated capillary branches, which appear as clusters of tiny red streaks on the skin's surface. The best treatment for these actinic changes is prevention. It is difficult to reverse these changes with chemical or surgical treatments. It is important to examine your own skin for long-lasting irritated spots and by getting regular physician exams of your skin as an adult. So, use some of these tips and go outside and enjoy the outdoors. We have run out of time for today's episode of Education Today. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Lisa Maxwell, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.